The masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close trusted view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Well.
Where would we be without THC? Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
People, we've heard guests attribute the highest rung on the conspiracy ladder to many different possible groups: Freemasons, Jews, Jesuits, Archons, Anunnaki, and even interdimensional spider beings. No doubt there are powerful people that weave all throughout several of the identified control groups, forming the most nefarious dream catcher you've ever seen. But if you really want to identify what gives them strength, it seems that the true mortar that built the power pyramid is banking. Here to make the ironclad case is returning guest John Hamer. You might remember him as the author of RMS Olympic and Titanic's Last Secret, which we talked about last time as we discussed the pretty well-substantiated claim that the Titanic was sunk on purpose once it was loaded up with the prominent opponents of the Federal Reserve. Really just another footnote in the big banker plot to rule over everything, but we also discussed the details of the elite's wealth extraction circle jerk they call charities, which John spends some time on in his 700-page conspiracy textbook, The Falsification of History, Our Distorted Reality. Well, John is joining us hot on the heels of another big undertaking. He just released Behind the Curtain, a chilling expose of the banking industry, volumes 1 and 2, together over 1,000 pages of good reason after good reason to consider the banksters to be the supreme societal string pullers and the architects of nearly everything. He is not messing around. It's a real pleasure to have him back. John, my man, how the hell are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Greg. Thanks very much for asking me back. I really appreciate that. And thanks very much for that fantastic introduction, too.
Oh, for sure, man. I had a great time last time, and I'm sure this will be no exception. Great to have you back. Anyone who puts out such expansive and detailed work is always welcome. So,
thank you.
Yeah, man. Of course, we can't get to the level of detail that you do in 1,000 pages, but it would be great to walk through the history here and point out not only some of the biggest manipulations, but also some of their lesser known ones as well. And to start us off, there's actually an enlightening little story behind the title of the book. Tell us why you settled on Behind the Curtain.
Yeah, it's as you say, it's quite an interesting little story. And I'll try and be brief. I don't want to drone on about it for a long time. But it started back in the 60s, in 1968, to be precise, in Minneapolis. A guy by the name of Jerome Daly, who was a lawyer, he got into trouble with his mortgage repayments, which at the time was about $14,000, which to us now, that kind of figure is laughable. But in those days, it was a considerable sum. And the bank, of course, took him to court to try and reclaim the house for him, as is going on today, absolutely wholesale, widespread right across the world. Mm-hmm. The banks are foreclosing people's mortgages and taking their homes away from them. But Daly didn't take it lying down. He decided to fight it. So he actually went to court and defended himself because he'd done a little bit of homework. He knew what the scam was. He knew what the banks were up to behind the scenes. And eventually, during the course, it was going against Daly for a little while. The judge wasn't particularly enamoured with his defence. The jurors were falling asleep. But then all of a sudden, the bank's president came to the stand and completely out of the blue admitted that it was standard practice for all banks to create money out of thin air. Right. So in other words, what he'd admitted to was the fact that the $14,000 that they'd lent Daly to buy his house had been created by bookkeeping entry, and it wasn't like a pile of cash that they had in reserve that they actually allocated to him and passed over to him. It was just a few strokes of pen in a book in those days. These days, it's digits on a computer screen.
Right.
But that was the point. As soon as he made that admission, suddenly the tide turned and Daly won his case. And it really should have been the catalyst for the collapse of the whole banking system, because the entire worldwide central banking system is based on that premise that all loans and mortgages are created out of thin air.
Mm-hmm.
And worse than that, they are all actually added, instead of to the debit side of the bank's double entry bookkeeping, they added to the credit side. So if you today were to walk into a bank and get a $50,000 loan for a car or whatever, they lend you the money, but they don't deduct it from their accounts. They add that $50,000 on. And this is standard banking practice worldwide. So anyway, to get back to the point, it should have been a far-reaching decision and crashed the entire financial system. But they don't allow that at all now. They've filled in all the loopholes. And in fact, shortly afterwards, somebody else tried the same ploy. And the judge said, and I quote, "If I let you do that, you and everyone else, it will bring the whole banking system down. We are not going behind that curtain." And that's where the name of the book comes from, because in fact, we do go behind that curtain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that little informational anecdote. You're right. It should have brought everything down, and it seems like it got close, and it got close a couple of times, apparently, over history, I've learned. But as far as this rich history is concerned, how far back can you take us? Obviously, the further we go back, the less detail we get. But I've had guests attribute the early stages of money to bankster priesthoods of Babylon who learned about these tools through their ritual use of magic. And that's maybe hyperbolic, and it's definitely vague, but talk to us about the starting place for you.
Yeah, well, I didn't really go back quite that far. I do sort of mention about, in biblical times, Jesus going into the temple and overturning the tables of the money changers. And that was, again, you don't really find the true story of that. But what actually happened was, it wasn't that he was just annoyed about people changing, you know, doing foreign exchange, changing money, although they were making exorbitant profits. It wasn't so much that. It was that the Jews, when they went to the temple to pay their yearly temple tax, they had to pay it with a solid gold coin called a half shekel. And the money changers actually cornered the market in it. So they were actually making, you know, charging even more than exorbitant charges for the Jews to get hands on these half shekel gold coins. And so it was that allegedly angered Jesus. And that's where, you know, and that's why he threw them out of the temple. I mean, all that's very apocryphal in it. I suppose it depends on whether you believe what it says in the Bible. But, you know, that was, as far as I was concerned, that was an interesting starting point. And from there you go right through the Dark Ages. Obviously nothing much known about the Dark Ages. That's why they're called the Dark Ages. But getting into medieval times, really, it was the Knights Templar that were the first proper, what you would call, bankers. And I think a lot of people understand what the Knights Templars are all about. And it's not the forum to go into that specifically. But they made a heck of a lot of money out of usury, which is another way of saying charging interest on monies loaned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And from there, the Knights Templars were obviously disbanded and murdered and all the rest of it. But then along came the goldsmiths. And what goldsmiths would do, realized that, let me just step back a stage.
Sure.
Yeah, money was originally gold and silver, something of intrinsic value, not like the paper stuff that we have today that is just, it's barely worth the paper it's printed on, you know, barely worth the value of the paper it's printed on. But gold and silver coinage was the first attempt at a proper, shall we say, medium of monetary exchange. And goldsmiths realized that eventually that it was a lot simpler, rather than having people cart huge loads of gold about because it was heavy, cumbersome, difficult to move about, there was danger of it being stolen, they could be attacked in the street and robbed, they decided to issue receipts for the gold, and they somehow became exchanged rather than the gold itself. So that's where bills came from, dollar bills, pound notes, as we have over here, £5 notes. So they had just in effect began as a receipt in exchange for gold and silver that the goldsmith kept in their vaults. But then something that really changed the world happened, and the goldsmiths realized that not all the gold was ever redeemed at the same time. So they realized that on average, it was about 10% of it that was ever actually transacted physically rather than through the receipts that they issued.
Mm-hmm.
And so they decided that they could comfortably lend 900% more gold than they had actually in their possession. So all they did was simply issue more receipts than there was gold, and they made themselves extremely wealthy overnight. And it's just gone from there, really. From there, we went on to the central banking system, which began in Amsterdam, in Holland, in the early 17th century. And then it went to England, the end of the 17th century. And from there, central banks have just taken over the whole world. And in a very small nutshell, really, that's how the money system has developed.
Right. And that is a great summary. And you talk about before the time of kind of the fractional reserve fraud that they do, for about 700 years, we were using tally sticks. And I'm not really surprised that we don't use notches and wood anymore, but they were pretty ingenious in their inability to be forged, right?
Absolutely. For those people who don't know what a tally stick is, as you say, it was just a stick, a piece of wood, but it wasn't a one that had been manufactured and planed and all the rest of it. It was just a piece of a tree, basically. And what they did was they marked notches in the wood, in the piece of wood, the stick, and then they split it. All those notches represent different values. So you might have one for because it was England, pounds. You might have one for £100, one for £1, one for so many pennies, blah, blah, blah. And then they split the stick lengthways down the middle so that all the veins in the center of the wood and the marks all matched up. So you couldn't actually forge it. It was impossible. So people used to walk around with bundles of these sticks to go shopping with, to make transactions with. And the other half was kept in a secure vault, and the ones that were freely distributed we used, as you say, as a currency. Yeah, it was very ingenious, but very, shall we say, inconvenient in many ways, I guess.
Yeah, definitely cumbersome and slightly inconvenient, but the wood grain pattern is as unique as a fingerprint. So having that, I mean, you know, getting away from that system is what allowed the bankers to take way more loans than the money they had and do this kind of fractional reserve issuing. Another piece of history that I liked is you do mention the death of Caesar in 44 BC. I think most people know his assassination was the result of a conspiracy cooked up by several Roman senators, but I don't think everyone knows why. I mean, banking was at the heart of this too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very similar to today in a sense because, you know, politicians are not independent people. They are there at the behest of lobbyists of various kinds. And it was much the same in Caesar's day. He was beholden to the money men, even at that time. Mm-hmm. And it was that what he did was he actually bypassed them. Again, it's the same old story. And this is a theme that you'll find running right through the book. Anybody who goes against these people, anybody who actually tries to bypass them or indeed annoys them in any way, are disposed of. And this was no exception for Caesar. What he did was he decided to create, for Rome to create its own currency rather than it be issued by the money people. And of course they didn't like that. So they actually instigated his assassination by Brutus and all the other senators that got involved. And as soon as that happened, obviously Rome was then beholden to them and it plunged into abject poverty, whereas it had been a very rich place in the time of Caesar because he was using the taxes and everything to build a public infrastructure and people were wealthy and prosperous. But as soon as the money gets concentrated in the hands of the bankers again, that's when poverty befalls a nation. And that this is a situation that we have today, exactly that.
Right. And it is so eerie how we're talking about something that happened to Caesar in 44 BC. And then just a couple of years ago, when the U.S. went into Libya and took out Gaddafi, it's now come out through, I believe, the Clinton email scandal. But it's come out that Gaddafi was working on a currency, a gold-backed currency, to get out of the central banking system. And that is why we went in. So,
absolutely.
You know, 2,000 years, it's the same game.
It's the same game and it has been all along, yeah. And there's been various different periods where the bankers have been on top and then the public, the general public, the people, if you like, have wrested control back. But I think, unfortunately, we now seem to have reached a point where the bankers have won, basically. And, you know, they've got the whole world in their thrall now, mostly. Mm-hmm. I think there are three countries in the entire world that are not part of the central banking system now. And there's no prizes really for guessing who those three countries are because they're the three that are most vilified by America and the rest of Western civilization. So basically that is Iran, North Korea, and Cuba. And guess which are the three countries in the world who come under most fire and pressure from the Western media? Those three.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, man. So to stay back in the distant past for a minute, tell us about the Edict of Expulsion, the 350-year ban, and Oliver Cromwell. Seems like an important little saga if you're talking about banking history, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, you're absolutely right to point that out, Greg, because this is what led to the formation of the Bank of England, which is, for American listeners, that's the English equivalent of the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the central banking power. What happened was, in, I think it was 1290, the year 1290 AD, King Edward I, I believe it was, issued an expulsion order for the Jews. And this wasn't the first time that had happened. I mean, Jews were expelled from hundreds, many different societies over the years, but this was the English version. And in fact, they weren't allowed back in until the 17th century in Oliver Cromwell's time. Now, Oliver Cromwell, again, for those who don't particularly know English history, Oliver Cromwell was the guy behind the murder of King Charles I, which almost turned England into a republic. Well, it did for about 10 years or so until the monarchy was restored. But what happened with Cromwell was, again, this is not in mainstream history. You won't find this in mainstream history, but it is documented. And I have seen the documents that relate to this. Mm-hmm. And what happened was the Jewish bankers who had formed the Bank of Amsterdam, which was the first central bank in the world in sort of, I think it was about the 1620s from memory, contacted Cromwell and offered financial help in deposing King Charles I, as soon as Charles was got rid of, they would allow the Jews back into England again, because they had plans for England, and that plan was to set up a central banking system. So Cromwell did as he was bid, and in my book, you'll see copies, you know, portions of the letters that were sent back and to between the Jews in Amsterdam and Cromwell, which have come from a very reliable source, so it's not just made up. And to cut a long story short, Charles was murdered, Charles was executed, and Cromwell became Lord Protector of England, but he died in about 1658, and the monarchy was restored. But in the meantime, the Jews have been infiltrating back into England again. And, you know, I don't want to pull any punches here. It is 90% Jews that are behind central banking and usury. So they took a little bit of time, and they had to get rid of another king, King James II. They had to get rid of him. He was sent off to exile in the 1680s. But in 1688, a Dutch usurper of the throne, King William III, came over for Amsterdam. He took over the English throne, and he sanctioned the formation of the Bank of England. And ever since then, the national debt has just spiraled, because that's the way that central banking works. Mm-hmm. But you were right. It was from that early beginning about getting the Jews back into England that really created the right, shall we say, political climate for that to happen.
Yeah, and it is controversial material for the conspiracy world. They've been dealing with this for a long time, but it does beg the question of if it's really fair, because I totally understand a government coming to terms with banking control schemes and wanting to end it, but I think they might have misidentified a conspiracy of race or religion with a conspiracy of class, because even if all bankers are Jewish, not all Jews were bankers. I mean, obviously, right?
No, of course not. No. It is a certain class of Jews, obviously, and not just Jews, but I'm keen to make the point that it is primarily Jews. And, that, mm-hmm. you know, there's no way dressing that up. There's no way getting away from it. I mean, there's no way pulling any punches on it, because it's a fact. You know, I'm not anti-Semitic in any way, shape or form, but I am anti-people who do things like they did. And the fact that they were mainly Jews is neither here nor there. It's just a fact.
Yeah. Fair point. And you do put the Rothschild family at the top of the pyramid. Obviously, that's a popular place for them in conspiracy content. But how can we be sure they've maintained their wealth and control to this day? I know skeptics of this idea always talk about rises and falls of empires and pockets of wealth. And it's not as simple or fluid as some of us want to make it seem, but dispel that for us. How did the Rothschilds stay on top for so long without ever getting the power stripped away during something like a revolution or a mass expulsion of Jews?
It was simply because, in my view, it was simply because they did it very surreptitiously. They came to prominence in the late 18th century, in the 1770s, 1780s, and they very, very quickly acquired an enormous amount of wealth. And obviously everyone knows that wealth is power, and they're very clever people. They weren't stupid people. They knew the right people to bribe. They inveigled themselves into royal circles, and they very quickly it wasn't a quick process. It was over decades, but they very, very quickly, relatively speaking, took over the whole Western world financial system. And spread the tentacles throughout Europe and eventually into the US as well, where their main sort of protagonists are the Rockefeller family, plus several others, but the Rockefeller are perhaps the most prominent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just drives me nuts because there's very few times over history where it seems like leadership has realized what was happening with the banking schemes and worked to overcome it. And it's just frustrating that these bankers were never charged or jailed when their charters weren't renewed, but it doesn't seem like their wealth was ever stripped from them, and it's just unfortunate.
Okay, well, we'll put it this way, Greg. If you were approached by someone and said, "I believe that anti-Semite John Hamer is coming on your show soon. Here's a million bucks to not show it, not to air the program," what would you do?
That is a conundrum.
Yeah, exactly. And I wouldn't blame you if you said, "Yeah, I'd tell you where to go, John Hamer."
I'll have you on 6 months later. How about that?
Yeah, the point is that money talks. And they very quickly established an absolute stranglehold, not just over royalty, but over governments, over the whole infrastructure of society, if you like. And that's how they did it. Mm-hmm. And obviously, that's a very simplistic version of events, but that's the truth.
Yeah, the point still plays.
Yeah.
So there obviously is a lot of history ground to cover, but let's lump in the major revolutions because they come from the same template. And to quote the book, you say, "The English Revolution was followed by the American, French, and Russian versions of the same trick, all at the behest and funded by the same group of people." Talk to us about this trick and how the banksters used it several times to get more wealth and power.
Yeah, well, first of all, what I refer to as the English Revolution, most people know as the English Civil War. That's just my way of referring to it. It was a revolution in the sense that it resulted in the murder of the king, basically. So it was usurped by Cromwell and his men over a long period of time. So that's why I call it the English Revolution, because I think civil war is actually, although it was a civil war initially, it became a revolution because the ruler of the country was deposed. Mm-hmm. So, just to clear that up, that's why I call it the English Revolution, if no one's ever heard that phrase before. Yeah, they all had slightly different, shall we say, purposes behind them, but they were all certainly instigated by the same group of people. And, you don't need me to mention the J word again. even the American Civil War, the American Revolution we're talking about now. By this time, and again, we're talking like the 1770s, 1760s, 1770s, England had already been usurped financially. We were almost 100 years into the central banking system in the UK. And I think, again, many US listeners may know what the real cause of the American Revolution was, and it certainly wasn't paying too much tax on tea, or however they dress it up. You hear different stories. But it was more to do with the Americans actually rejected the central banking idea. And they actually produced something called colonial scrip, which was their own currency, which bypassed the English central banking system. So, of course, the English central banking system, which was completely dominant in English society, took exception to that and sent its mercenaries in to quell the Americans. And, obviously it didn't work, allegedly, but that's another story for another day. I think you know what I mean. But, mm-hmm. And then the same thing happened in the French Revolution. The French Revolution wasn't as we're led to believe at all. It was just a way of a certain group of people again trying to take control of the French government and impose central banking upon them too. We were told that, oh, it was a popular uprising, the French Revolution, because the poor peasants were starving and all this. They were treated really badly by the royalty. And I'm sorry, but it's just absolute nonsense when you look into it. And again, there's plenty of information to be had on that particular topic, but it was nothing like it's portrayed to be. And lastly of all, the Russian Revolution in 1917, I think that's fairly common knowledge now amongst, shall we say, alternative media and truth seeker sort of world, that it was the, once the Federal Reserve Bank had been created in the US, then this actually created a whole boatload of money, a lot of which was sent by Jacob Schiff, who was part of the Federal Reserve, high-flying banker in the early part of the 20th century. And he paid a lot of expatriate Jews to go over and take over Russia and kill the monarch there. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, it's a long, much longer and more complicated story than that. But basically, they're all the same story, just slightly different versions of the same story, if you like. But it's all got the same foundation, and that is based in central banking being used to take over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the power is so entrenched now that when I look at the history of central banking in America, the back and forth is really interesting, because before we had the Federal Reserve, we had the Bank of North America. And then after that, we had the First Bank of the United States. Tell us about this back and forth and some of the people involved in this seldom discussed saga of control that's pretty entrenched at this point.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, after the American Revolution and independence and all the rest of it, they immediately tried to get a central bank going in the US. So although they actually, as ridiculous as it sounds, although they fought the War of Independence to gain freedom from central banking, it wasn't long before, again, the bankers wheedled their way back into it again and tried to get a central bank going, which they did. As you say, it was the Bank of North America, was it? I'm just,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that began. And then eventually the people, at that time, the people were far better informed than they are today, because there wasn't the weight of the media as such then as there is today. So people in general were far better informed, and it was a lot easier for sort of people in government to reject things that they didn't believe in, whereas today they're more or less coerced into doing everything that the central banking powers want them to. But in those days, there were independent thinkers such as Andrew Jackson is a good example. He fought tooth and nail against the bank. And it's so ironic now that I don't know whether it's some sort of a joke by the bankers, but Andrew Jackson's image is on one of the bills, isn't it? Is it $20?
Right. Yeah, the $20. And up until now, they're going to change it to Harriet Tubman. But yeah, for so many years.
Yeah.
A real slap in the face.
Yeah, he was the biggest opponent of the bank, and his presidential campaign in the 1830s was built on the slogan "Jackson and no bank, kill the bank." So he understood the inherent badness within the central banking system, and he fought against it. So that was successful for a while, but then as the 19th century dragged on, obviously the American Civil War came into play, and I'm forgetting the exact history of it now, but as you rightly said, there were two more attempts to get a central bank in America, and they both failed because of the will to defeat it, because people were more savvy in those days. They knew what these people were about, and they knew that it would always be detriment to the people and to the benefit of the people. So there were a couple of other occasions when the central bank was formed, but it didn't last very long because there was no real sort of impetus behind it. It was criticized and it couldn't sustain itself. So it was in the early 20th century when bankers got together again for one more go at it. And this time they really put their heart and soul into it, and they produced a campaign, a really dirty tricks campaign of deceit and lies, and coupled with other things. And eventually they more or less sort of fooled Congress into accepting it. And yeah. the Federal Reserve Bill was passed in 1913. And the rest is history, really.
Yeah, we've been screwed ever since. And I get how people could fall for it, because it is kind of a complex trick to uncover how unfair it truly is. But once you see what happens with a central bank and you actually overcome it, it's insane to think they could get one installed again and twice even.
Yeah, well, the different times, I guess, Greg. You know, it was if a politician was opposed to something, it wasn't necessarily in the pocket of these people at that time. So it was in some ways easy to fight against it. But once, with the advent of the mass media in the late 19th century, although it was only newspapers, there was no radio or television, obviously, but the mass media and also propaganda and things like that became to be understood better, and they could use basically any dirty trick in the book to convince people that black was white. And that's exactly what they did, and how they got the central bank in the US established.
Mm. Yeah. And I wanted to read this little paragraph about the War of 1812. It's a little long, but it's pretty great. The main opposition in Britain to the Rothschilds and their revenge war with the Americas was the Prime Minister Spencer Perceval, who was soon disposed of at the hands of a lone deranged assassin, the first and absolutely definitely not the last of those who stand against the banksters to suffer a similar fate. He was recorded by history as the only British Prime Minister to be assassinated while in office. His assassin, John Bellingham, who was very quickly and very conveniently tried, convicted, and hanged, was strongly rumored to be in the employ of the Rothschilds, and this would also mark the first time that the Rothschilds would be associated with, or rather conveniently benefit from, a political assassination. Last part here. For the record, Perceval was murdered on the 11th of May, 1812. Bellingham was immediately arrested. He made no attempt to escape, but sat down and waited to be arrested.
Yeah.
Definitely some interesting history there, man. But it sounds like he could have been the first mind-controlled patsy, too, based on that last line.
It just sounds like that, doesn't it? I don't know if that was the case or not. But, yeah, it just sounds like that. But, yeah, Perceval was against the, you know, the renewed – because, yeah, again, a lot of people may not be aware, but after the Revolutionary War in the States, England had another go to try and get it back under control again in 1812, and they were defeated at – was it the Battle of New Orleans by – it was by Jackson, wasn't it? Andrew Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But Perceval was against that, and he wouldn't allow troops to be sent back across to America again to subdue the colonials. And that's why he was assassinated by Bellingham. Yeah.
To kind of throw some fuel on that fire, I also wrote down an Andrew Jackson quote here, and it perfectly sums up the parallels to problems that we have had several other times, most recently during the bank bailouts. But here he says, he so politely says to them, "Gentlemen, I have had men watching you for a long time, and I have convinced that you have used the funds of the bank to speculate in the breadstuffs of the country. When you won, you divided the profits amongst you, and when you lost, you charged it to the bank. You tell me that if I take the deposits from the bank and annul its charter, I shall ruin 10,000 families. That may be true, gentlemen, but this is your sin. Should I let you go on, you'll ruin 50,000 families, and that would be my sin. You are a den of vipers and thieves. I intend to root you out." And that's powerful, but it does summarize that catch-22 situation that you're in once you are entrenched in the banking system, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And what a fantastic quote that is. I just love it. I really do. It just sort of encapsulates everything that it's all about, in a sense.
Yeah. To fast forward a little bit to the time of the Civil War, something else I found interesting was some of this info about the Knights of the Golden Circle. This was a powerful secret society that wielded power in the Confederacy, of which the notorious Jesse James and also John Wilkes Booth were apparently members. Tell us about that group and some of the history here concerning Jesse James in particular.
Yeah, the Knights of the Golden Circle, as you say, they were a secret society. They're an offshoot of the Freemasons, in effect. And they were involved, as you say, in the southern states. Jesse James, as everyone knows, was murdered by his cousin Bob Ford. Or was he? Apparently not. Jesse James lived to the age of 107, and he died in his bed in the 1940s. But, yeah, the Knights of the Golden Circle were involved with the story of John Wilkes Booth and the assassination of Lincoln and all that stuff. And again, that is a far more complex story than it is given credit for today. Booth certainly wasn't killed while he was on the run. He survived that, and he was one of the Knights of the Golden Circle as well. And he were, and for some reason, they decided that it was expedient for them to say that Booth had been killed whilst fleeing. But in actual fact, he survived and he carried on. But it was Jesse James that actually murdered Booth. I think that's correct to say. Yeah, because Booth was a Freemason, and he actually was going around bragging to getting drunk and bragging to everybody who he was and what he'd done, and also about divulging secrets of Freemasonry. And so as far as the KGC was concerned, it was a far greater crime to tell the stories he was telling than it was to assassinate a president. So he was bumped off by James. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. Definitely, yeah. A saga that people aren't familiar with.
No, and again, it's not just my speculation, Greg. There's lots of evidence to back this up. You know, I didn't just put stuff in just for the hell of it. You know,
right?
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, 1,000 pages. You've got lots of things sourced in the book, that which makes it easier to read with confidence. You know, but
yeah, sure.
Of course, there's more to say about banksters and their secret societies. You go into quite a bit of depth here, and a lot of us know the basics, but was there anything that you found that wasn't contained in, say, the conspiratorial 101 handbook? We know there are connections to Isaac Weishaupt's Illuminati and the Freemasons, but talk to us about the depth of those connections that people might not be aware of.
Oh, yeah. Well, as I say, the banksters, they are... the ruling elite are what I call the banksters. And although they're not all bankers as such, they are all banksters. And just bear with me a second here, because it's not so easy to just say, I've got to sort of do this preamble first. And that is that I call them the banksters because they own the banks and they own everything else as well. If you go to the top of any pyramid in society, whether it be, I don't know, something innocuous like the Boy Scouts, whether it be, you know, the Federal Reserve, whether it be individual banks, individual corporations, they're all part of the same big club at the top. At the very top of the pyramid, they're all part of the same club. So whether they're bankers, banksters, they are the people who rule the world. They are the controllers of the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a simple equation, really. And there's not an awful lot to say about it.
Yeah. And we did mention the Federal Reserve. Of course, people know that is the central bank we have here in America right now. But you write about it in quite a bit of depth. You talk about the Jekyll Island Hunt Club and the infamous meeting on Jekyll Island that gave us the Federal Reserve. Talk to us about it, some of these players and maybe some things that people wouldn't have uncovered if they didn't go to your level of depth and study that you have.
Yeah, well, obviously, the plot had been going on in banking circles for quite some time. But eventually, in 1910, I believe it was, a group of the nation's top bankers went on this clandestine mission down to an island just off the coast of Georgia called Jekyll Island, which was it's like a private resort, in fact, for the very, very wealthy. And it was all done in the utmost secrecy. Only first names were allowed. They were called the First Name Club. People like Nelson Aldrich and J.P. Morgan's representatives. I can't remember all the names off the top of my head because you can imagine there's a lot of information in there. Van der Lip as well was one of them. But it was basically all the big banking conglomerates pre-Federal Reserve that were involved in this scam, if you like. And they went down to the Jekyll Island Hunt Club. They stayed there for a couple of weeks. They formulated their plan, not just how the Federal Reserve Bank was going to work, but how they were going to set up this campaign to pull the wool over everybody's eyes, to bribe the media, to bribe politicians, to make everybody think that this was a jolly good thing. And, you know, the American economy will collapse unless we do anything about it. Unless we bring into place a central bank, there's going to be abject poverty nationwide. And they produced this massive, extensive campaign that was designed to obviously pull the wool over everybody's eyes. But, you know, a lot of people saw through it. But that, to go back another step, had been instigated in 1907 because there was a massive run on the banks in 1907. And J.P. Morgan, who was, you know, one of the leading lights in the finance world at that time, virtually bailed out the U.S. government single-handedly because the government was in danger of going bankrupt and therefore falling. And so they owed him big time, basically. So that was quite a nice little lever that they had into – that level of control, if you like. So it was from that island, that meeting on that island, that the plan was devised to generate goodwill behind the formation of the Federal Reserve, and it actually won the day in the end.
Right, and they had to put it through on Christmas Eve weekend.
Yeah.
So that there weren't going to be any opponents or senators there to really see what was going on. So that's when they rammed it through when no one was around.
That's right.
And of course, you were our Titanic conspiracy guest. But for those who missed that show, how solid is the connection that the Federal Reserve opponents were strategically on that ship?
Okay. Some of that is speculation, I have to say. It just very neatly fits into the jigsaw. You know,
It does.
But having said that, I do know that Strauss, Isidore Strauss, Benjamin Guggenheim, and John Jacob Astor were the three of the four wealthiest opponents of the Federal Reserve System. And it was just a nice little coincidence, maybe, that the year before the Federal Reserve was actually came to pass, that they all died together in an accident. So, you know, that's fairly convenient, I would have thought.
Right, yeah, three birds, one stone.
Yeah, the fourth member who wasn't on the Titanic was a guy called Charles Lindbergh Sr., who was the father of the famous flyer, the Spirit of St. Louis guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he was a big opponent of the Federal Reserve, and he wrote a book called, I've forgotten what the book's called now, Currency and the Banking System or something like that, which absolutely laid bare every nasty element of the proposed Federal Reserve System. And he was offered $2.5 million, which in those days, I mean, it's a fortune today, but in those days it was probably about, you know, $250-300 million, not to publish it. And he turned it down, but it never actually did get published, because I think the would-be publishers had been got out as well, so it never actually got published.
Right. It is kind of hard to fathom how over so many years these banksters could get their tentacles into a society so easily. But you're right. If you just find somebody, of course, you're going to be able to find an agent, find somebody in the government who actually can make decisions and say, hey, we'll make you one of the richest people on the planet. You know, just let us get our currency in there and then we'll give a bunch of it to you.
Exactly. And the beauty of it is, Greg, is that they knew that once the Federal Reserve was established, it enabled them to create money out of nothing. So money was nothing to them. You know, they could bribe people with absolutely massive amounts of money. It didn't make any difference. It was no detriment to them. They're just plucking it out of thin air.
I mean, how stupid must they think? From their perspective, the whole world has to be just a bunch of morons, because you're just printing your own monopoly money and people are working jobs 40 hours a week their entire life to get that paper, and it means nothing.
Absolutely. Yeah. It only means what we believe it to mean, and we believe a dollar bill is worth a dollar bill, and that's it. If we suddenly said, no, I'm not accepting that, I don't believe it's worth anything, I'm not taking that, the whole system would collapse. It's just the belief that piece of paper is worth the equivalent of $1.
Yeah.
But what is $1? Well, I mean, originally $1 was one ounce of silver? It was something along those lines.
Right.
So it had like an intrinsic value, and all a dollar bill was a receipt for a 1 ounce piece of silver, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, to take it back, the whole line is you have these tally sticks. And then that evolves into, okay, now we have something that's represented by a receipt, but it's still backed by real gold. You don't want to lug gold around. And then they extract that from the paper currency. And now we're at the farthest element removed from any real wealth or any real security or tracking of any kind. And it's all just ones and zeros. They say, I think, like 85 or 90% of the money supply is just ones and zeros on computers. They haven't even printed real money. I mean, that's the furthest degree of separation from wealth and paper money. I mean, I don't know where they go from here, except to straight digital currencies like Bitcoin or something.
Indeed. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that will come, you know, Bitcoin, and there are other, what they call cryptocurrencies as well as Bitcoin, but obviously Bitcoin was the first and that's the most sort of important at the moment. But yeah, that will come. And I think they fought against that at first, but now they're accepting that that's probably the way of the future, and it's becoming more accepted now, Bitcoin, but it was really frowned upon originally, and, you know, by the powers that be. But mm-hmm. I think they realize that they can't stop it because the momentum behind it is quite strong, actually.
Right.
And that's a good thing, I think.
And I've had several guests who talk about that being a major element in the elite's plan right now is a move to a cashless society. And as we extrapolate that pattern of where we've come from those tally sticks, that's the last thing to control, because most people obviously don't keep huge sums of cash, but someone could. And if you're going to have a collapse and someone, you know, out in the middle of the desert has saved up, you know, $100,000 in cash, you can't control that with your ones and zeros because they've actually got the physical dollars there. But if you move to a total cashless society, you know, anyone who makes a problem for you, you can just turn their bank account to zero and say, fuck off.
Yeah.
You got no resources now.
Absolutely. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. I mean, the thing about Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is that at the moment, I'm not saying it always will be, but at the moment, as I understand it, it's outside the control of the central banking system. So that can only be a good thing, because they envisage a cashless society that is going to be under their control, not outside their control.
That's true. And I mean, I have to be honest, I own a decent amount of Bitcoin because I'm hopeful in that very same thing. But I'm also skeptical, because how else could you sell a new currency except by saying that it was outside of their control? And when it's all computerized, I'm just not 100% confident. I want to be. I'm hopeful that it is. Yeah. But
I'm the same, actually. I've actually bought into OneCoin, which is a competitor of Bitcoin. And that's just really at the beginning now, but it, you know, it's forecast to do pretty well. So I'm quite hopeful of that.
Right. Yeah. So fingers crossed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just another hedge of a bet, really, isn't it?
Right. It is. So you also have a chapter where you detail what we call the 13 main families of control, loosely called the Illuminati families. Of course, we know Rockefeller, Rothschild, DuPont, Astor. We know some of these, but there are lesser known ones like Bundy, Reynolds, Krupp, and Lee. Can you shed any light on the less public families in the club if you know details about any of them?
Yeah, well, the American ones like Bundy and what was the other one that you mentioned? Sorry.
Reynolds, Krupp.
Reynolds. Well, Reynolds are the tobacco magnates, aren't they? They were the people who sort of virtually got a monopoly on the tobacco industry in the US. Mm-hmm. Basically, I mean, just in a very small nutshell, what all these families are. Well, Lee is an exception because Lee is Chinese, but I'll come on to that in a moment. But certainly the American ones, they're just the big industrialists, which I lump together as banksters. Because if you remember back to the original definition of banksters, it's not necessarily people who are involved in banking directly, but they have fingers in pies. And as I said, at the tops of all these pyramids, so at the top of the tobacco organization, at the top of the steel industry, at the top of the banking industry, at the top of any other industry, the railway industry, whatever you care to name, all those people are involved. Whether or not they actually have controlling interests in banks, they may not have, but they've certainly got controlling interests in much of American industry. And basically, it's all one big club at the top. So I lump them all together. To me, they are just one group of people. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly how they behave.
That makes sense. And the Lee family seems to be one that is a bit of an exception to the rest.
Yeah, the Lee family are involved in, you know, the triad movements. The Lee family virtually control China, I would say single-handedly, but that's not true because there are an awful lot of them, but it's a big family. But they're behind a lot of the corruption, the drug running and all the rest of it between China and the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, because there's a massive opium crop in China, I'm sure you're aware.
Right.
And all the triads are controlled by the different branches of the triads, the Chinese gangsters, for people who are not aware what the triads are. They've infiltrated most cities in the world, really, certainly the major ones. And it's different branches of the Lee family that control different aspects, different elements of it, gambling, prostitution, you know, drugs, the usual stuff. And they do have these inter-family squabbles from now, you know, from time to time, and bump each other off and all the rest of it. But basically they are, you know, they control much of the commerce, shall we say, both legal and illegal, between China and the rest of the world.
Right. Kind of like the Rothschilds of the East.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, good description, yeah.
And you also spend some time on the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, as you should. But yeah. Then you mention a group called the Jason Society. You call them a branch of the Order of the Quest, one of the most influential elements in the Illuminati. That's a bit new to me. I'm not familiar with the Jason Society. What can you tell us about them?
Yeah, the Jason Society. Yeah, I mean, as you say, they're just another element of a similar element to the CFR and the Trilateral Commission. But the Jason Society are the real elite of those two organizations. So only the people at the very top of the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations are part of the Jason Society. The Jasons are the elite, and they sit immediately under the very top of the pyramid, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's not an awful lot to tell. I mean, they're just involved up to their eyes in it, just the same as the rest. But they have a greater degree of control. I mean, you know, you can get people, ordinary guys like politicians who've been good lads and done as they're told. They can join the Trilateral Commission. But not the Jason Society. That is really way above those sort of people.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, they're very secretive things, and they're all just fronts for similar groups. But it is always fun to hear a new name, you know, in this quest to uncover what they're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, I would advise anybody to actually Google it, because it's quite interesting. There's a lot of stuff to talk about. But if you think of that as being more generational based, so it's a bit like it's passed down through father, son, uncles, brothers, blah, 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 you know, all the rest of it. Whereas anybody, once you reach a certain point in the hierarchy, can be invited to join the CFR or the Trilateral.
That makes perfect sense. That's a good way to separate the one from the other.
Yeah.
So as you point out in the book, the shareholders of the big central banks spread around the world are never really fully disclosed, but many of these big families and the British royals are heavily suspected of being some of the shareholders. Can you tell us what we do know to be true in the realm of central bank ownership?
Well, only that we know for sure that the Rothschilds are involved, and it's suspected very strongly that the British royal family is involved. And all these central banks, they're not just, you know, restricted to each individual country. So, you know, the Bank of England is not a separate entity to the Federal Reserve, is not a separate entity to the German Central Bank, the French Central Bank, and so on, ad nauseum. They are all intrinsically connected, either by families, by birth. That it's just I keep using the same expression, but it's just a massive club at the top. And, you know, it's all these multi-generational families, you know, such as the royals. But unfortunately, I can't elaborate anymore because there literally is no details. A lot of it is speculation.
Yeah.
But it's for certain that the Rothschilds are involved because they began it all. You know, why would they relinquish control over it? And also I find that it's quite significant to me. You never see in the Forbes or over here in Britain, the Sunday Times rich lists where it gives you a list of who the most wealthy people in the country and the world are.
Right.
The Rothschilds never appear. And neither does the British royal family. I mean, that should really tell us everything we need to know, shouldn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, obviously. So there is a lot of great stuff in your chapter about the British royal family. But if I had to pull out just one thing to talk about, it would probably be the Kamloops and Mission Indian residential school situation and this whistleblower, William Arnold Combs, because it gives us a sliver of proof for something that a lot of us think is probably a much bigger problem. But what happened there?
Right. Apparently, according to William, I think his name's pronounced Coombs.
Okay.
But he was of Canadian Indian birth. He was a native Canadian, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an orphan from a very young age, and he was put into this residential school where a lot of the children were abused. And there's a guy, again, if the listeners want to look him up, a guy called Kevin Annett, that's A-N-N-E-T-T.
Right.
He writes a lot about this, and it's from him that I got this information. And talking about the reservation schools in the sort of early to mid-20th century, where it was like endemic child abuse and murder going on with the native Canadians and the children, that is. And apparently the Queen of England and her husband, the Duke of Edinburgh, paid a visit because obviously Canada is part of the British Commonwealth, so they go over there quite regularly, see all their buddies over there. Apparently the Queen visited them in the early 60s, and about 16 or was it 16, maybe 12 of them, went on a picnic, and the kids never came back.
Right.
And this is true. This is, you know, this is not just, again, just not my speculation or pie in the sky. This is true. You know, there are lots of witnesses to it. Kevin Annett puts a lot more detail in it than I did in my book, because quite simply there wasn't the space.
Right.
But so this guy Coombs that you're talking about, there was actually to be a court case where Elizabeth, the Queen, had been summoned to attend in England about 4 or 5 years ago. Obviously, she was never going to go because it wasn't official, in inverted commas, in quotes. But the trial of her was going to take place anyway, and Coombs was going to be the main witness for the prosecution. And he died the week before. He'd been perfectly healthy, and he was taken into hospital, and he died suddenly at the age of 59.
Damn.
Yeah. So that was that story. I mean, a lot of people believe that the royals are up to the neck in all that kind of stuff, child abuse and murder and all the rest of it. And I've got no absolute proof, but let's just say I wouldn't be surprised.
Exactly. And looking at these little stories gives us an indication of what might be the bigger picture. But if there isn't a child pedophilia ring, if they're not involving kids in strange rituals to some degree, why would the Queen show up to this, you know, resident, this school, and then extract half a dozen kids or whatever and just leave with them? I mean, what else do you need kids for? But
exactly. Yeah.
So we're starting to move pretty fast here, but take us into World War One. Where do we see the bankers pulling the strings here?
Right. Well, again, it's all intrinsically connected to the Federal Reserve, because it was actually the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913. The bankers had been plotting World War One for a long time, but they knew they had to get the Federal Reserve in place first, because simply we go back to that old chestnut again of being able to print funny money to fund it. They couldn't possibly have funded every side in World War One without getting the printing presses going and having nothing back in that money. So once the Federal Reserve was established, it was then a very short jump to World War One. In fact, you know, World War One happened less than a year later in Europe. Obviously, in the States, the Americans didn't come in until 1917. But it was raging in Europe from the middle of 1914. And again, it was all financed by America, by the Federal Reserve money, because they knew, again, the banksters, the people who not only run the banks, but run the industries, the armaments industries, the steel industry, any kind of provision for war, knew that they would make an absolute killing. And I detail that in quite a bit of detail, the profits that were actually made by the various branches of industry in the book. But it was all artificially created, you know, as a profit-making enterprise, basically. And it was the Federal Reserve that allowed them to be able to do that.
Right. And in making the case that these banksters are the string pullers of pretty much every situation through history after World War One, the Depression is probably the next big major thing. Of course, it's long been considered to be a banker-controlled situation, but maybe you can tell us a little more. What was going on behind the curtain of the Great Depression?
Right. Well, again, the early 1920s, from 1920 onwards, once the First World War had finished and prosperity started to return, the bankers, again, with central banks, it's important to understand that they can pump as much money into the economy as they wish. They can extract money from the economy if they wish as well by restricting credit, i.e. restricting loans, because it's loans that generate money and therefore generate inflation. So they pumped lots and lots of money into industry, into society in general. People were prosperous. It was just a crazy time, the 1920s, especially in the US. And it got to the point where people were being encouraged deliberately to invest in stocks and shares. I mean, people, you know, ordinary people, blue collar workers, just ordinary guys, laborers, had not done that sort of stuff before, because it was only for the wealthy. But the bankers devised this plan whereby they would artificially generate this boom, if you like, this boom time, encourage everybody to invest in the stock market. Then, of course, they planned it quite carefully that sometime during 1929, October, they would have a plug pulling session And so they immediately began selling everybody who was in on the scam. And it was, again, it was all the usual suspects at the tops of the trees. Suddenly, in October, began pulling money out of the stock market. And once that starts, you know, it's a spiral, a downward spiral. The stock prices start to fall. Everybody gets out. There's a run on the bank. And there's bankruptcies, banks going bust, you name it. That, you know, thousands of banks went under, right. Banks outside of the Federal Reserve banking system, of course, not the Federal Reserve itself. Ha. And of course, then what that then allows them to do is once all these people are made penniless and homeless, they can then buy back, because they've already taken their money out, so their money is safe. They can then buy back all these assets that people are desperate to offload. Pennies on the dollar, basically, and that's exactly what happened. And the Great Depression lasted about 5-6 years before it began to, you know, recover. And that actually led to the Dust Bowl for various reasons. You know, the big Dust Bowl in the 1930s, where thousands and thousands of farmers starved, were homeless, went bankrupt. The mass emigration to California and all the rest of it from the, you know, the Central Plains areas, mm-hmm. which was the breadbasket of America, wasn't it? But, you know, there were lots and lots of farmers went under, and again, those properties were bought for pennies on the dollar, and it's all just one big scam. That so-called boom and bust cycle that our mainstream media economists tell us is just part of the natural cycle of money, which is complete bullshit.
Of course, and
yeah.
So you know, they put us into a bust cycle, extract all the wealth out of the system, and then
yep.
the thing to get the wheels turning again, of course, is a war, World War II. That's what they
yep.
that's the only way they really let us get back in the game. But obviously there's a ton of deception and manipulation when it comes to the World War II story. But to hit it from the bankster angle, one quote you do say that's interesting. Of all the things that's going on, you do say Winston Churchill sold out to the banksters against the welfare of his own nation to line his own pockets in the manner of a modern Judas. And
yeah, absolutely.
Those are pretty harsh words. What did Churchill do here? It was so bad.
Well, it's quite interesting, actually. If you read about Churchill's life and his attitudes and his views from the First World War, right up through the 30s, everything he says is pro, is anti-bankster, it's anti-banking, it's pro-Hitler, it's pro-Germany. Then all of a sudden, in the mid-1930s, he has an absolute, complete change of heart. And it's now known, and again, this is fully documented, it's not my speculation, I know I keep using that phrase, but I'll keep saying it. It's fully documented that he was actually bribed by the Jewish elements within the central banking system to actually foment a war against Germany.
Mm.
And it's quite obvious. You know, there's just a paper trail, if you like, of quotes and of things that is said and done that makes you realize that nobody could make such a U-turn without actually, you know, being bribed. And it's quite believable that he was bribed, because he was heavily in debt. He was a spendthrift, was Churchill. He used to spend a lot of money on lots of different things. Young boys, for one thing. He was very much into paedophilia with young boys.
Yikes.
He was a fetishist of ladies' underwear, and he used to buy expensive silk ladies' underwear for more than pairs that cost more than a working man's monthly wage at the time. he was a real big spender, and he got himself into awful debt, and the only way he could see out of it was basically to sell his soul.
Mm. Man, that obviously is an important aspect of history. And also with World War II, there's so many things going on, but the formation of Israel, of course, is a huge part of the aftermath and still is an ongoing issue today. How were the banking elite involved here? What was this really about? Because I believe it's the setup for a possible third world war.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, if we go back a few years, in the 1870s, a guy called Albert Pike, who was the most senior Freemason in the United States, wrote a letter to, I believe from memory, it was one of the Zionist leaders at the time. Zionism was a new up-and-coming, what should we say, belief.
Trend, yeah.
In at that time. And Albert Pike wrote this letter stating that, you know, he was basically in their corner, and that the Illuminati, the banksters, whatever name you want to apply to them, would instigate three world wars. The first one would result in the Russian Revolution, bearing in mind he wrote this in 1875, and the deposing of the Russian Tsar, the king. The second one would result in a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. And the third one would be fomented by creating friction between the Christians and the Muslims. And sitting in the middle of all that, again, it's that group of people that we keep talking about, the Jews, but specifically, again, I want to make the point. I am not anti-Semitic. I think the Jews have been, as a group of on occasions have been badly done to by lots of sections of society. But the problem is, it's the people at the top, the Zionists, if you will, who create that situation nowadays whereby people become anti-Semitic because they believe it's all the Jews. Well, it's right. Not all the Jews. It's just a section of them called the Zionists. And it's the Zionists that cause all the problem. And again, to be fair, not all Zionists are Jews. There are many Christian Zionists and they're just as culpable as the Jewish Zionists. So I just want to make that clear in case anybody thinks that I'm being unfair in any way or racist or whatever.
Yeah, those qualifiers, of course, everybody puts them out there. But I mean, it is true. What's really happening is the people we're really trying to target are hiding within a larger group. And that's what makes them hard to identify because there aren't the terms for them outside of these things like Illuminati, banksters, elite. But they're hiding within this bigger group. It's a lot of the reason why they never get fully charged and convicted. And the other people in the group that aren't the elite have suffered the worst because they're getting the brunt of the
absolutely
the bad PR, but they also aren't getting any benefit to being in that group.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, there's a lot of propaganda from Zionism to Judaism. There is a lot of propaganda that says that the two are interchangeable because it's in the Zionists' best interest to make that so.
Right on, man. Well, we could do it all day. I got to let you go eventually. It has been a lot of fun. You do great work. Hopefully any listeners who want a pretty complete look at history through the puppet strings of the banksters, I don't know a better book they could get. So please remind the people where to get Behind the Curtain and all other books that you've written and places they can follow up with you and your work.
Okay. If you just go to Amazon.com and key in my name, John Hamer, H-A-M-E-R, you'll find all the books that I've written on there.
Nice. Ayana, are you doing the Twitter thing?
I'm just about to start. My son is actually going to, as soon as this show is finished, my son is going to give me my first ever lesson on Twitter.
Nice.
I'm going to start doing it, yeah.
Well, definitely let me know your handle on there so we can let the people know. We can start getting the ball rolling on Twitter for you.
I will. That's great.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, man. Maybe we can do this again sometime, but keep doing the good work you do and enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, thanks a lot, mate.
All right.
All right, all right. John Hamer back in the saddle for a second helping of your favorite show. Great guest, I'd say. His books are very extensive, well worth your time. You hear me say this a lot, but I just wouldn't book a guest if I didn't like what they wrote, but I do gravitate toward these books that really take you through everything. Totally self-contained, so if someone says, what do you mean the world is controlled by banksters who orchestrate every war and play economies like an out-of-tune guitar? Well, I'd say read Behind the Curtain, because in 1,000 pages you'll hear history from that perspective, and it's a pretty well-rounded case. It's funny how the people who are so sure conspiracy advocates are nuts have never read one of these books, because they changed their mind. And with this book in particular, you get breadcrumbs of other threads that I think are just as interesting and important. That's largely what we got into in the second hour, and it's one of these shows that I really wish everyone could hear, because after the first hour, when John opens up about NASA and the misdirection of modern science, that is when we get into some great places. You know how sometimes you might want to talk about a particular fringe idea to a friend or coworker, and you kind of toss out an entry-level comment just to feel them out and see if they throw anything back, and then they come at you full force with like, dude, I know all about that. You ever have those moments? I used to love that kind of thing back when I had normal, regular interactions with new people. but weaving through history and pointing out banker manipulations, this is a serious THC staple, and I thought we hit on some new areas of the story that were probably new to you. In that second hour, though, discussing how the banking industry was involved in the moon landing hoax and how part of its function was as a smokescreen for the Vietnam War, that really opened up a can of worms in the NASA science realm. Then we talked about something I've discussed with a lot of guests off the radar, off the air, and that's how some missing or abducted children can be traced back to the actions of the CIA and the further implications of that. A lot of people don't want to talk about it, but John mentions it in the book, so I went for it. If it's dangerous to talk about, it's in the plus show, so there's a slight bit of security there. It's not just floating around. Then we got into why technology is being suppressed and some of those unallowable options that would make the world a better place. And then as we got into solutions, I went on a bit of a rant about the basic income idea, which I'm a big fan of, have been ever since the Ellen Brown show. I've been thinking about trying to get her back. She also just wrote a new piece about the weed revolution and Monsanto, so there's another thing to discuss. So many possibilities, so little time, right? But that pretty much closes out the month of June. I will have a Money Bomb winner. Hopefully we'll get a message on the next episode. They haven't been great about giving me those messages, but I think we are going to be winding down the Money Bomb program in the next couple of months. I'm just getting too busy trying to hold all this up, and something's got to give. Participation is lower too, but anyway, I know we've had a couple weak shows in the fairly recent past, but let's look at June. Marty leads in the Flat Earth, not for everybody, but a pretty well-received show overall. Russ Baker on the Bushes, well-researched and knowledgeable guest. Patrick Jordan and Judith Vary Baker with a vaccine weaponization 1-2 punch. And John Hamer taking us home. I think it's been an informative and well-diversified month. You know, please sign up for the Plus Show if you agree. We're doing just fine, but I have to admit, I did not expect to lose sometimes a dozen or more subs a week just because their cards expire and stupid little things like that. Maybe they've lost interest too, but we had a great push for show notes, and I think they've been a great addition, but I hope you guys aren't getting sick of me already, because I don't know what I'm going to be doing at 75, if not this. So please, offer up that $5 a month, $30 for 6 months, or $60 for a year, and let's keep the party going. Call me ambitious, but I dream of a future where guests can't say nobody in popular media will cover X, Y, or Z because we have just as many listeners as anything else. Is that crazy? Maybe, but you do have to be a little crazy to do what I'm doing here, I think. And the trick is to just not go over the edge and self-medicate to your heart's content. But that's it for me. Thanks for all the support and for listening. It is a dream come true. Really, it is. And that's it for me today. Your move, bankster oligarchs of the Rothschild Rockefeller reality. Your fucking move.
Oh no, you see, the world isn't random, it's attached to puppet strings. Control over everything. The 9 to 5 is trying to steal you. Now don't that job seem silly? Hello, can you hear me? Or should I play back recordings from some spy agency? Wish we were younger and free. I'll be thankful when it's all exposed, the vast conspiracy. There's such a difference between us and the damned Rothschilds. Hello from the higher side. They're calling out 1,000 cries. They'll tell you the story of everything that's been done, and they'll call out deception of the web that's been spun. Hello from the higher.
wounds. It's so typical of me to talk about this stuff. I'm sorry, that's good and well. Did you ever hear the argument that nothing really happens? It's no secret that the best is plus. It's doubling your time.
Guys, thanks for listening to the first hour of the Higher Side Chats podcast with me, Greg Carlwood. If you don't know, there is a second hour to all the episodes we do around here. Generally, we're able to get a lot deeper into the topics and ideas that a guest is about, so if you enjoyed what you've heard from THC for free, consider signing up at thehighersidechatsplus.com to get the second hour of the five shows I put together each month. I never really wanted to be a paid subscriber podcast, but I really hate the idea of spending airtime promoting some product that's completely unrelated and telling you the best way to support the show is to buy an audiobook or new underwear by mail or something crazy like that. So instead, if you like the show, double your time with it for $5 a month and let's cut out all the other shit. It's half the price of a movie ticket and you get at least an extra 5 hours of show a month. Collectively, it keeps us stable and it frees me from wasting your time with anything but the show you came to listen to. It's really the only way for an independent, one-man show to make it, and I do what I can so that it's worth your while. Since we started this, I've always tried to use the subscriptions to improve the podcast and make signups more advantageous. It started with just a second hour for the main show, but now we've got a nice forum going where people can get deeper in conversation about the episodes with other listeners, submit a candidate in the guest request thread, or share their own personal projects to get out of the soul-crushing 9-to-5 cog-in-the-wheel life on the entrepreneurs thread. The forum and the plus comments are always the first places I try to go for listener engagement, but it does get harder as the show gets more popular. Because of that, there's also a direct messaging feature that you can use to reach me through the plus site also. But beyond the forum, if you like any of the music I've used for THC, most of it I've hired artists to make, and I provide it all as free downloads to Plus members too. So if you like a particular song you've heard close the show out recently, come get the MP3. I should also mention that if you don't like the idea of paying $5 recurring every month, I get that. You can buy 3 months, 6 months, or a year up front and just be done with it. I have plenty of listeners who send checks and money orders to the P.O. Box too. I try to make it as easy for people as I can, and you can read more about it on the sign-up page. Also, be sure to check out the FAQ help page on the Plus site if you have any questions or concerns about how to listen to a password-protected show on your devices. I've highlighted a lot of great solutions, and one of those would be the iPhone app that just recently hit the Apple App Store. A super kind and talented listener made it for us, and you can use it to stream or download either the free or the Plus show. If you're on Android, I'd use Pocket Casts or Podcast Addict and subscribe to the feed manually that way. I also try to throw in occasional bonus shows or Q&A shows, and I've got a few other weird ideas I might get to try out soon. But I give you all I can for $5, and I hope you'll at least give it a shot if you've listened to a few free shows and you find them unique or valuable. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there, and I'm just one of them. But if you have any questions, concerns, or comments about any of this, please get in touch with us at thehiresidechatsteam@gmail.com. I also wanted to plug the Higher Side newsletter I'm going to be putting out, totally free for anyone who wants to sign up at the main internet website for the show, thehiresidechats.com. You can also get on that email list through the Higher Side Chats Facebook page. There's a button there as well. But the reason I'm doing this is because I get tons and tons of emails after a show goes up asking me about how I feel about a particular guest or topic, and the wrap-up isn't always the best place to do that, especially if I have anything negative to say. Sometimes the dust needs to settle. Sometimes I need to hear feedback from you guys first. There are a lot of factors, but I usually have something to communicate to you, and I just don't get to do it. So on the first of the month, I plan to send out a little newsletter with my thoughts about the 5 shows the previous month and talk to you about anything else that's on my mind or that's going on. And what's probably most enticing is that I'm going to give you some insight into at least one guest I have coming up in the month, which people have been begging for some posted schedule for a long time. I personally think I'd like the surprise. But sign up for the Higher Side newsletter. It's free. It comes out on the first of the month, and I won't waste your time with any other emails. And that's it. I appreciate you listening. I try to give alternative ideas and guests a fair shake on a high-quality podcast, expose some deep-level conspiracies without the yelling, and I hope to offer some inspiration that even though the system relentlessly suggests you should follow their blueprint to mediocrity, you can do your own thing and live a much happier life despite all the negativity in the world. So go ahead and treat yourself. Isn't it about time?